Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. I was calculating, actually, this is the 23rd of our results breakfast, which was instituted by our friend that we miss a lot, Frank Lucas. And it's grown a lot since then, but thank you for coming. There's a results meeting, so you know, the bulk of the presentation will be given by Brad. Most of you know Brad, who's our finance director, and less of you know Mark, who's been now with Judges like a year and a half, who's the CEO. As we will discuss, you know, a lot of the credit for these results go to Mark. So I go quickly through the first few pages. Judges Scientific, for those who don't know us, we're doing a buy and build within the scientific instrument market. We think it's a very favorable market to do this because of three things. Long-term growth drivers of the scientific instrument sector, a large pool of acquisition targets, and low capital requirement, which means that the profits which are generated by our subsidiaries is recycled into new deals. So we've done 16 acquisitions since we started in May 2005. And I think we've developed a very good reputation in the world of scientific instrument and among people who want to set a business. And it is, of course, very important for us in implementing our business model. And we're very disciplined in our acquisition activity. We try to buy only things that we really convince are going to produce what we're looking for, which is, you know, sustainable profits, cash generation, and also, if possible, growth. At sensible prices. So, you know, the model is quite sensitive to the price we pay for these deals. And we think that all these ingredients are really the key to creating shareholder value, which is our only obsession. So if you read the FT today, you see capitalism has to change and we have to really forget about shareholder value, and we have to do, you know, we have to be there to be angel and save the world. We don't believe at all in this thing. We believe in being good citizens and good employers and good buyers and being honest and doing an honest job. But our only obsession is with creating shareholder value. So the next page shows a bit the group and our acquisition activity. For the first time, we have a map showing where all these companies are. And I'm sure I'll have a lot of questions. Where are they all within an hour and a half from London? Except, of course, we're showing a very small reduction of the USA, where we have four companies have an office there in the same building. And as you will see, you know, we've had good years and bad years in our acquisition activity. And I'm sure we'll have questions about this. But it's by nature erratic. So just to explain who buys scientific instruments, well, universities, we sell, you know, a lot to universities, the most prestigious one, but also some more obscure ones. We haven't put the obscure ones. We also sell to industry because people are always trying to improve the products they're making. And then we sell to the compliance sector. A lot of our instruments are there to test compliance with certain standards. And of course, research centers like the CERN or the Allen Institute. But we also sell to OEMs, which basically is sometimes companies which sell an assemblage of things which make up an instrument, and we sell one of the components of this thing, companies like Rigaku or Thermo Fisher. So next page five, the key messages really of this interim statement is, you know, we're very happy at a very good financial performance, and all our financial metrics have gone up. We've been helped in this, as we've said several times in the last two or three years, by really good foreign exchange. I think last time we had the breakfast, for those who were there, I said, well, maybe it's the end of it. Well, it's not the end of it. And, you know, just for that aspect, all the shenanigans are very good for judges. So because it's been good, we're going to pay a 25% increased dividend. The main driver of all this was organic growth because we didn't do any deal. A lot of the growth was due to, you know, constant search for operational excellence, R&D investment that, you know, we've been, you know, pushing that for the last 5 years now. And of course, we're benefiting from the diversification of our business to geographies and different markets and different applications. And the outlook for the year as a whole, well, order intake was satisfactory and it's consistent with our targets for the year, but hasn't been fantastic. We'll talk about this also. But, you know, with the figures we already have in hand and the order book we have, which is healthy, we have confidence really that we're going to beat the expectations which were in the market until today. Okay, and then please, performance review is in your hands.
Oh, good morning, everyone. I'm now going to take you through the key highlights for the past 6 months. And now we've had strong financial performance over the past few years, and this has continued through the first half of 2019, with revenues up 9% to 40.2 million, up from 37 million in the previous period. And this high single-digit growth, coupled with good control of our cost base, has materially improved operating profits to 8.6 million. That's an increase of 26%. Flying through to earnings per share, that's also progressed similarly. That's up 30% to 108.7 pence. That's up from 83.4 pence in the first half of 2018. Now, underpinning these results really is there's two factors to them. So the first one is order intake, and our order intake is up by 4.2% in the period, and more on that a little bit later. But also through our continued drive to improve operational excellence. And that resulted in a small compression of our order book, meaning that results were better than we otherwise would have expected. We've also got a strong track record of turning profit into cash. And we generated 8.5 million of cash from operations in the first half. This enabled us to strengthen our balance sheet, moving from a net cash position of 0.9 million at the end of December to 7.4 million at the end of June. And it also enables us to fund our growing dividend, which, as David mentioned before, is up by 25% for the interim dividend to 15 pence per share. Overall, we continue to deliver strongly for shareholders. And you'd have read from this morning's statement that the strong financial performance in the first half of this year, coupled with that order intake we've had since the end of the first half, has meant that we're confident of exceeding market expectations in terms of profit before tax and earnings per share. So I'm going to take you on to look at performance in a little bit more detail. We had a good first half, as I mentioned before, revenues up 9%. And you can see our operating cost base only up by 5%. And that enables us to get the operational leverage and the growth in our operating profit, as I mentioned before, 26% increase. Just want to talk about tax for a moment. Our effective tax on adjusted earnings has increased from 15% to 15.6%. It's very much a factor of the strong growth in performance with a partial offset from the UK's generous R&D tax credit scheme. For a business like ours, it's an excellent scheme. We invest heavily in R&D, and because we have less than 500 employees, it's a very, very beneficial scheme. That having been said, the R&D benefit doesn't grow in line with profit. And so because we've had high profit improvement, the effect on the effective rate as such diminishes a little bit. For those of you less au fait with our P&L, we do have adjusting items that take you to the statutory result. The vast majority of those by far are non-cash amortisation of the intangible assets which we recognise and are forced to recognise when we acquire businesses. And I just want to stop for a second and just talk about changes to accounting standards. At the beginning of the year, as so many of you will be aware, we, along with all other quoted companies, were required to implement the new accounting standard on leases, IFRS 16. And for many businesses. It's had a very, very significant impact, both on the results and also how they present information to investors. Judges' results, I'm pleased to say, were not unduly impacted. And whilst we've had to recognise offsetting assets and liabilities from the 1st of January in the balance sheet, the impact on our P&L was not significant. And what we've done is replaced rental expense with a combination of depreciation and interest. But the net effect of that has only served to reduce our earnings per share by less than half a penny. So not a significant impact. And we've done our best to map this out clearly for shareholders in the interim statement. Just moving on to slide 9, order intake. Our group is reliant on order intake in order to deliver profitable performance. And I want to talk you through the graph on the right-hand side of the slide, which is what we use to assess order intake performance on a weekly basis. So there are three lines on this graph, a red line, a black line, and a green line. The red line is our internal sales budget, and we set this every year as part of our annual budgeting process, and it doesn't move unless we make an acquisition, in which case then we add the cumulative sales to that target. And it's really our target every year. And we measure against this the two other lines. So the black line is our trailing 12 months of orders. So it's a historic look back on the last 12 months of orders. So what we're looking for is for, by the end of the year, the black line to at least be touching the red line, because that then means we'd have had sufficient order intake to satisfy our sales budget. And then you look at the green line. The green line is a shorter term measure. It's the last 4 months of orders annualized. So it's by nature a more jagged line. And we hope that will track there or thereabouts around the red line, but it will have some lumps and bumps in it because order intake is never smooth. So what happened in the period? Well, you can see that the black line was, for most of the period, in line or slightly ahead of the red line. And the green line started the year above the red line, so that was a good start, and it dropped back during Q2 a little bit below our target. And that's what we explained in our trading statement. At the same time, you can see the black line has still trended up a little bit against the previous year. Now, since the period end, we've had 10 weeks of orders that we've been satisfied with and have returned us back to budget levels. And so that gives us confidence of completing 2019 satisfactorily, and hence the statement today. That all despite this wider, uncertain economic outlook. Moving on to revenue, on slide 10. We continue to be a high exporter. And you could have seen from our results that we've got close to 90% export in this period across the whole globe. Look at the actual revenue we generated in a bit more detail. Continued strongly in North America, with strong growth there. And China has returned to growth as well in this period. The rest of Europe up a little bit. UK's been flat, which hasn't greatly surprised us. And the rest of the world dropped back a little bit. But in fairness, primarily to do with one of our companies in India last year having a particularly good time and nothing else of any great concern. And you can see on the right-hand side from the graph that orders broadly align with the revenues we've delivered in the period. Moving on to our profit bridge. And this sort of helps everyone see where our profit growth comes from. You can see, firstly, for those of you that I've presented this to before, the graph is a bit less busy than it has been in previous periods. And one particular point of note of why that is because of the operational recovery of one of our businesses, which has now returned to health. But overall, when you look at this, you see a positive overall picture of growth. At the same time, when you see the red block that we have in this, it's not been plain sailing for all of our businesses. That having been said, when you see that we've got contribution for the first half of 2019, which is close to 10 million, so this is contribution, just to remind everyone, that is from our businesses before any central costs. That close to 10 million contribution set against our revenues of 40 million shows we're getting closer and closer to our target on average of our businesses having a 25% EBIT margin. And that's testament to the work that Mark and all of our businesses have been doing over the past recent history. Moving on to balance sheet and cash flows. You continue to have strong cash generation, and that's helped improve our net cash position, as I mentioned before, from 0.9 million at the start of the year to 7.4 million at the 30th of June. Just wanted to touch on a couple of other small points on the balance sheet. One, our defined benefit pension scheme that we acquired with Armfield in 2015. It only has 40 members, is close to new entrants, close to new accrual. And the liability has increased primarily because discount rates have reduced during the period. And as David mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, one of the features of our businesses is their low capital requirements. And you can see that our working capital remains at less than 10% of annual revenues. And considering the growth in revenue we've achieved in the first half, we've not had to invest that into supporting working capital. And that's a great feature for us. Moving on to cash flows and really following that working capital point on, not needing to invest in working capital enables us really to turn so much of our profit into cash. And we had 98% cash conversion in the period. Now, it's to be open with everyone, it's slightly artificially inflated by a few percent. You'll see from the slide that I've said on there that it would otherwise have been 94%. And really, just to explain that, with the new standard that's come in IFRS, what's happened is that what used to be a cash rental expense in the top part of our cash flow has turned into depreciation and interest, and therefore then sits now towards the bottom as a financing cost in our cash flow. So it's, you know, 94, 98% for us doesn't really make a lot of difference because our expectation is 90 plus percent cash conversion. So either way you look at it, it's still very good. But I think it's important that you understand what's happened to our results in the period. And this strong cash generation is really what it's all about for us. It helps us continue to be able to make space for acquisitions, reduce our acquisition debt, and provide increasing returns to our shareholders in terms of dividends as well. So one other key measure for us, if you move on to slide 13, is return on total invested capital. And put simply, it's a function of the multiples we pay for the businesses we acquire. So we start on the left-hand side of the graph with our first acquisition, FTT, and we paid a little less than 5x for it, which means we started a bit above 20%. And growing ROTIC really requires improved financial performance and or acquiring businesses at lower multiples. You can see the impact of higher multiples in the middle of the graph. When we acquired GDS and Scientifica at multiple of 6x, you get that cliff drop. And also when we acquired Armfield as our other big acquisition at the beginning of 2015, another little dip. Smaller acquisitions now make less of an impact on ROTIC because of the size of the group. And you can see at the end of the graph, we achieved a ROTIC at the end of the first half of 31%, and that continues the improvements we've had over the past few years. And we mentioned previously that our medium-term target for ROTIC was 30%. And you know, having achieved that, we've got to strive to keep pushing on. On to slide 14. I think a helpful point David touched on earlier as well in the key messages. You know, we're a well-diversified group. You can see from the split of revenue for our businesses, there's no one single company that dominates. Additionally, our businesses manufacture instruments for different scientific markets, so we're diversified by scientific application. And you can also see on the right-hand side of this slide that there's no one country or region that overly dominates. So lastly, before I hand back to David, just want to take you through some key financial statistics about the long-term success of our business. Revenue, profits, EPS have all grown strongly over the history of our group. And this first half, we've continued that trend with record revenues, record profits, and record earnings per share. We also have compound organic annual revenue growth of more than 9%. And that, for a group that has a business model predicated on acquiring sustainably profitable companies at sensible prices, is a creditable achievement. The dividend, which has increased by at least 10% every year and has a compound growth of in excess of 20%, is up, as we mentioned before, by 25% to 15 pence, and it's well covered by earnings per share, as you can see from the graph on the right-hand side. And then lastly, our focus continues to be on cash generation. It helps us ensure we can pay down the acquisition debt, make space for acquisitions, and continue to provide growing dividend returns for our shareholders. I'm going to hand you back to David now to talk about strategy.
Thank you very much, Brad. So, you know, I talked before the growth drivers. Sorry for those who've been here before, but they've heard that because it never changes. And I think one of the things which is important is that it doesn't change. And we think that our sector is driven by two things. First, you know, enormous growth worldwide in university education. So a few days ago, there was an article also, I think it was the FT, about lodgings for students. There was thinking there would be a real boom in that, and will that continue? And I think there was saying that there was students in the year starting in 2000 was, I think, 350,000 students. So you have to provide accommodation for that. And last year was 555,000. Some of you may have seen this statistic. It is spectacular that a country which is developed like the UK could have such an enormous growth in 19 years in the number of students starting university. And if in a country which is developed like the UK, this is happening, what is happening in the rest of the world in countries which 50 years ago didn't have any graduate students? So this, we believe, is a very, very, very strong growth driver for scientific instrument, bearing in mind we sell a lot of instruments to universities. We think maybe something like one half of our turnover. The other thing which we don't think will change, this is why I'm boring you every time with this, is a constant thirst for improving everything that we do as human beings. The world is always trying to improve and optimize everything. And, you know, like everybody knows about the Moore's Law, like, you know, every 2 years you have to double the efficiency of the electronics contained in the particular volume. And everything we do is like this. And this is not going to change. You know, there is going to be a constant drive for many, 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 many years to come. That everything human beings do, they're going to try and do better than they were doing before. And to optimize things, what do you need to do? The first thing is measure. You can't optimize something we didn't measure. Like, if we didn't have accounts, thank you, Brad, well, we wouldn't have a good performance. Like, everybody knows a business which doesn't keep accounts, it can survive, but it's not going to progress. So measurement is a key. So really, when you think that instruments are used for education, for research, and for compliance, and for improvement of everything people do, you know, we are sure that we're going to have a lot of growth over the long term. So these are the drivers. And of course, another driver for our particular business, research and development, we spend 5 or 6% of annual revenue, which is usually more than the businesses that we buy were spending before. And of course, you know, we try to optimize everything we do, like everybody else, we said, but we try even more since the last year and a half when we have Mark. So I'm sure Mark will talk a lot about what he's doing to optimize the way we operate. So really, you know, one could ask, and I'm being asked that question very often, so sorry for asking my own questions, but why, when you buy sustainable businesses, that's what you look for, why do you get 9% compound organic growth over a bit of 14 years? This is not logical. You're looking for one thing, you're getting something else. Why? And I think the reason why, I think you have to look back and see what is it made of, that 9%. Well, first, we're a world business, exporting most of it, so you can't compare our growth with the growth of the UK. but with the world growth was about 3.5%. So what's the difference between, what feeds that difference between the 3.5% and the 9%? And we believe is the particular characteristic of our sector. And when you're in a sector with a lot of growth, if you buy the best companies, you're going to have even more growth than that. And research and development, this is also driving. And of course, we wouldn't spend 5 or 6% on research and development if we didn't hope that that would feed growth, which is over and above the 3.5%. We just sit and enjoy. So this is about organic growth. I haven't talked about much about M&A because we haven't done a deal for a bit. So I was trying to dodge this one, but I think I need to go back there. But really, there are a lot of companies in our sector. It's made of a multitude of global niches with not a lot of competition, which is what why we managed to achieve nearly 25% EBIT margin before head office costs. And it wouldn't be possible if we were not in niche areas. So there are a lot of companies. It's very hit and miss, as we've seen. It's been a bit more miss recently. But, you know, we have to remember that our worst year was 2016. And in that year, we did 4 deals. So we hope that we will have more to talk about in terms of deals in the future. What are we trying to do? Well, we're very disciplined. We look for companies which are international companies, so not companies which are parochial and just dealing with their local market. And we hope to have a global niche and some domination of that global niche. And we're looking at a solid and sustainable EBIT margin and good cash generation. They all have good cash generation because they have very little assets. So, of course, a lot of what we pay for is, of course, goodwill, and this is why we have all the adjusting items. In the past, we've been paying 3 to 6 times EBIT according to size. The size is really relevant mostly if you're below $1 million EBIT or above $1 million EBIT. And we've been paying a lot more for companies which are above $1 million EBIT. And we haven't done a lot of deals above $1 million EBIT because it's a lot more competitive. And we're allowed to borrow up to 2.5 times EBITDA. And we pay rates according to how much we borrow, which are like 2 to 4%. So when we don't borrow a lot, and we don't often hit the 2.5%, like recently, so it's closer to 2 than to 4. So, of course, you know, the arbitrage we do is really not between the multiple we pay and our own multiple, because we don't like to issue a lot of shares, and we've issued very few shares, and this has been a big factor in creating value. But it's more an arbitrage on the return we get on what we buy, and the money we have to pay to the bank. So if we pay 2.7% to the bank and we buy something for 4 times and we get 25% on our money and there's good cash conversion, hence we get 25% cash return, then I think it looks like an easy equation to resolve. So the deals have a long incubation period and random, so sometimes you spend a lot of time trying to do something and you end up not doing it. So it's very erratic crystallization. But what we do is we provide a lot of certainty for the sellers, and we have that reputation that once we've agreed heads of agreement, we will not diverge from that. And we've always been well-financed. And the only deal we did which required a placing was the first deal. The next 15 haven't. And so, you know, if you have the money and you're honorable, once the guy gets into that process, which is long and difficult for sellers, because they also have to run a business, I think they need to see the end of it as a certainty, and I think they do. So that's helped us a lot. And what do we do post-acquisition? Well, we always need to put in financial controls, which are often better than they had before, if they had any before. And of course, you know, we start reducing debt, and then we want to reinvest the proceeds of all that in further acquisitions. And then, you know, we're a very decentralized group, and we really leave a lot of autonomy to the MDs to run their business. And we don't micromanage these businesses. So one of the keys, of course, to have a very good MD. So recruitment, you know, identification of MDs, recruitment of MDs when they retire, or of course, if you've made the wrong choice, you know, when you buy a business and you find this guy and you think he's going to be good and he's not good, so the replacement and training and all these things are really important, and support and peer networking and benchmarking, all these things are very, very important. And of course, this is Mark's role, and I'm not going to say more because I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions. But of course, succession planning is very important, and it's getting more and more important. In the early years, we didn't have any, didn't even think about succession planning. Now, we have a lot, you know, spend a lot of time on that, organizing leadership program, and really keep people focused always on the long term, you know. And we buy these businesses for life. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, basically, you know, you're like a quoted private equity house. We're not, because we keep these businesses, and when you when you have a business for life, you take care of it very differently from if you buy a business, you're trying to optimize it to sell it in 5 years. It's a completely different attitude. But we also need everybody within the group to have this long-term attitude and focus on long-term prosperity. And everybody needs to be, you know, an entrepreneur in itself at every level. We like everybody to be imbued with a spirit of enterprise. And it does work. So outlook, we've talked about the outlook in the statement. You know, order intake is in line with expectation. We wish it was much better than that, but it's okay. You know, of course, the world is, you know, a very raucous place at this point. And of course, the quarrel between the US and China impacts, is capable of impacting our markets a lot more than Brexit, that everybody is obsessed with Brexit, but I think it's a much bigger topic for a company like ours. And, you know, we're confident we're going to beat the expectation for 2019. So, you know, why bother to buy our shares? Well, you know, I think we have a good business model. We're pursuing it with discipline. And, you know, I'm reminded, I think, you know, I'd like to quote a re-quote from Charlie Munger at the last AGM of Berkshire Hathaway. And he was quoting Lee Kuan Yew. And I mean, it's such a stupid thing, but it's so true. Lee Kuan Yew said that, figure out what works and do it. You know, and this is judges, you know, we figured out quite by chance, we were in a terrific sector. And yeah, there was company like this and like this and like this. It works. And we do more of the same. That's what we do. So a good pool of target, good growth driver, good diversification. We all focus on shareholder value. We're not distracted by anything modern. Profitability, cash generation, debt reduction, growing the dividend, and creating a return on capital. We've produced 24% compound growth rate on dividend, but never less than 10% for the past 13 years. And then, and of course, I mean, I'm not talking about the interim dividend, but last year the dividend was 4 times covered. And if you do the sums, it means that we could keep our promise to grow the dividend 10% a year for 14 years without growing profit at all. Okay, so it basically means that without growth, but without disaster either, have to be said, we're more or less guaranteed to have 27 years of no less than 10%. And then for private shareholders, most of those who are getting on a bit, it's free of inheritance tax if you hold the shares for 2 years. So that's we think it's an interesting feature. And we think that among the companies which benefit from that business property relief, we're one of the safest and most attractive companies to buy in these portfolios. That's it. So thank you very much for listening. And now, you know, questions, if you have any. Otherwise, food.
Two questions, Brad, and for Mark as well, really, I suppose. For Brad first, just in terms of the sort of CapEx plan for the business. Clearly, I mean, return on invested capital has risen fairly smartly, driven by a lack of acquisition activity. But clearly, the businesses have needs as well. And it just strikes me that for every sort of pound of capital that you deploy, you're sort of sweating that with 1.8 pounds of sales on a, you know, 20% margin, you know. So, I mean, is there the opportunity to deploy additional capital? You know, what's the capital plan? And for Mark, I guess, kind of related, first half saw a terrific performance in sort of sweating the assets of the business operationally. Sales lead times came down significantly, and clearly, you know, the impact on the margins have been strong. So, granted, some of that activity is one-off. What else is there to do?
If I answer your first question, our businesses, we don't constrain them from wanting to invest in CapEx. It's more about what they need. So you'd appreciate, and you know our business well, but you know, we have a range of assembly, if you're a manufacturer, across all our businesses, from one end where one of our businesses makes everything from scratch to the other end where they subcontract everything. So clearly design and retention of those and of those products remains our own IP, but this is about the how we put things together. So at the far end where you're subcontracting the assembly of everything, you don't require capital. At the other end, you require more because you want to make sure you've got good, high-quality, up-to-date machinery to help you make the products you're making. And everyone else is somewhere in between. The majority of our businesses require the desks and hand tools and things like that, which never, you know, even if you updated them regularly, wouldn't require a huge outlay of capital expense. But why would you buy something every year if it lasts for 10? And we certainly believe passionately in that. This, going back to the business that makes almost everything or almost everything, well, we support their continuing plan every year, but that might be one machine a year that's maybe 100, 150,000, maybe a five-axis machine that's probably the most expensive they bought, cost 125,000, I think. So within the context of the group, we're not really needing to spend, even including investment in new systems, much more than £1 million a year anyway. Obviously, as the bigger the group gets, that will increase, but we don't have to invest heavily in huge, you know, production lines or things like that because we're not a volume manufacturer. So it is a feature of the businesses rather than say to them, if we throw some money at you, what can you do? Because actually, they can't really do any more with capital. Now, if you move the question away from capital to R&D, then that's a slightly different question. And of course, we have only ever expensed our R&D. So you won't see that in the cash flow because it goes straight through the P&L. And the R&D that we do invest, which works out around 5 to 6%, is, again, an encouragement to our businesses from us to show us profitable projects. And if you can show us they're profitable, we'll help you invest in them. We'll support your investment. And we certainly don't constrain our businesses unless there was a situation where they had too many projects for the staff. And I think at that point, you want to make sure that they focus on the most important ones. But that's a fairly rare occurrence for us. So I think from my perspective that we support our businesses in everything they want to do, provided they've shown to us it makes sense. And Mark might want to add something to this as well as answering the other question you asked. Sure. I guess I'd sort of start off by just picking you up on the word sweating. I mean, my view is that the businesses, you know, don't need to sweat, as it were, with the implications in that. Most of these businesses that when we buy them are run typically by very bright people with detailed experience in the industry, often engineers, often PhDs in a specialist subject. And what they're great at is the technology and the industry. But in many cases, they're not professional MDs. And actually, the thing more than anything they need to understand is what is being a professional MD involve. And as the business gets bigger from 12 people to 20 people to 100 people, it requires different skills. You need to be able to attract good people into professional roles running R&D, production, sales and finance. And so that the sort of leadership and professional MD skills become really important. And so moving the MD from a technical expert and a customer expert to a professional leader. And I think that's, as David mentioned, something that we've worked really hard on and is paying some real dividends. So I see that as being relatively low-hanging fruit rather than the sweating. The sweating to me implies that, you know, we're at 90% and we're trying to squeeze a couple more out. I think in some areas we've been at 60 or 70 and it's a relatively gentle process to get us to 90. And, you know, it's all the basic stuff. You know, what's a reasonable level for debtors? And, you know, our big invested capital is, you know, inventory levels and debtors offset by creditors and a little bit of fixed assets. Now, fixed assets, pretty small number. Most of these businesses, we're talking about 2% of sales, so it's vanishingly small. So actually, the issue tends to be around debtors and creditors. What's a sensible number? Well, if you've only been an MD for 5 years and never before, you know, you might think that 50 days is a good number. And then I introduce you to one of our other companies who, despite the fact they deal with Procter & Gamble in France and large numbers of multinationals across Europe, never get above 30. And everybody says, well, how do they do that? So maybe 50 is not a reasonable level. So by doing a little bit of gentle benchmarking around the group, we can reduce the capital employed just by showing people that they don't know what they don't know. And that can very quickly lead into it. So I think in terms of managing the working capital, that's really what's going on there. Just showing people what they need to know. I think Brad's point about R&D is also, you know, conceptually that's an investment, even if we expense it. You know, most of these companies, if they can find a project to do, these projects are extremely high return. So, you know, typically, you know, you go to business school and people look at 10-year projects and huge discounted cash flows and stuff. You know, most of these projects, we're talking about investing 50 grand in something with a 4-month payback. So this is not a difficult investment case. It's, you know, if by the time you finish writing the one pager on it, it's a yes. And it's just a question of, can you find enough of those? Is there a new product which this industry will buy? Because if you can find one, it'll make money way beyond any investment.
I have a question. It's been quite a while since you made an acquisition, about almost 3 years, I think, something like that. And you before that, you bought about 5 companies in a short period of time. How come it's so patchy? Are they asking too much money for the businesses? Is there some prospect for purchases? And are you paying the bank for loans that are not being taken up?
Yeah, well, I think if you go again to that page, I think it was 2. Page 3, you see that it's, you know, it's very spasmodic. But of course, there you see only the deals that we've done. And of course, we've pursued a lot more deals than those that we've done. But we have the failure rate is abominable. And I think there's, of course, a large number of reasons why we fail. You know, sometimes we go into a company, we find there's something we don't like, you know. So, tough. And we have to be disciplined that even in the dry years, like 7 and 8, and you know, 18. It's actually our last deal was 2 years ago, was Oxford Cryer. In the dry years, you have to be disciplined, not go and buy things you wouldn't buy in the good years. Of course, often there's a question of price. For the larger deals, a lot of competition. You know, companies making more than a million a year. You know, everybody wants to buy them, and a lot of private equity funds. And sometimes they're more generous than us. And then sometimes, you know, you don't have competition, but on smaller deals, the guy wants to sell it, but it's not enough money. So he prefers to keep it. So it's basically, your competition is the seller. So you have all these things, and you know, you just need the failure rate to be a little bit above what it was the previous year, and then you don't do a deal because you fail very often. So you just need to fail a bit more often, and then you have a year where you haven't done a deal. You have to accept that. And, you know, I have to say, some people say, well, you know, if life is tough, well, you should have more deals, you know, it should be great. Like 16 was a bad year. People said, is that the reason you did four deals? Not at all. And actually, in the recent past, we've had two deals that we were pursuing for a long time, which failed because their results went down. And of course, then you couldn't agree with a guy because, you know, he had his expectation on getting a certain multiple on a figure. And they had, you know, a difficult year, and it was less than his expectation. The deal was dead. Not dead forever, maybe. And sometimes, you know, some deals we've pursued for 10 years. So, yeah, does it answer? I know it's not a satisfactory answer. We'd all like to have visibility. See, we do a deal a year and to know, you know, every March we're going to do a deal, but it's not like this.
Do you have to pay for the bank facility?
Yes. Yeah, the answer is yes, we have to pay for the bank facility. And, yeah, and the bank would love us to use it instead of paying for the unused bit.
And was there a reason why you did about five deals around the 2016 period?
I think the failure rate was better.
But there must be more to it than that. Maybe expectations, the prices were lower. No,
I don't think so. We just was it was a lucky year. We had more hits and less failure. But yeah, it was just a good year. Can't say, you know. You can't pinpoint what makes a year a good year or a bad year.
Isn't it price?
Yeah, but why in a certain year? You're going to find a lot of companies where the guy is prepared to accept a certain price. In another year, people are not. This is the difficulty. We haven't found the... Maybe there is an underlying reason, but we don't know it.
Can I ask a couple of interrelated questions, please? I know the reasons why international acquisitions are less attractive in terms of multiples you might have to pay managing those businesses, but given the lack of deals in the UK, have your horizons broadened to try and find some deals? I'm guessing I know the answer to that, as in no. The second question then is maybe more for Mark in terms of the scalability of the business. The question that I think we've been asked the most frequently is, how far do you think you can take it in terms of acquisitions, even just in the UK, with the existing kind of format in terms of managing those businesses, given that I think, you know, Mark, you spend a lot of time on the road. It'd be interesting in your view as to how you think that will develop over the next, say, 5 years.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I start with your first question. First, yeah, you know, you've noticed they're all close to London. It's not because we're lazy, and we're looking at acquisitions everywhere. But this is what you have to say. First, we get a lot more deal flow in the UK because in the UK we're starting to be well known as an acquirer of businesses and a desirable acquirer. A lot of people, if they market their company, they tell the company marketing it, talk to judges. We'd like to do a deal with judges. So this doesn't happen much in other countries. Then there's Europe. It's not that far. But the problem is, in most of Europe, people don't value companies like us. You know, we like to value them at multiple of EBIT, and they like to look at asset and what they've spent in R&D in the last 25 years and this and that. Okay? So we don't mind a conceptual debate, how do you value companies? But the problem is, their method always comes to a figure that doesn't comply with, you know, what we think is the right price. So we found the looking for these in Europe very frustrating, but we keep looking. By the way, we did one deal in Europe, but it wasn't on a multiple basis. It was a very small business in Belgium, one of the four of 2016, but it was a one-off. Then there's America and Canada. We've seen quite a lot of deals. We've offered for many deals in America and Canada. The problem you have there is that they understand EBIT multiple, but they don't understand the same EBIT multiple. So what you'd pay six times here, you have to pay eight times there. So you and of course, we don't want to buy standalone companies in the US or Canada, which are too small. So, you know, here we're happy to have a new business unit which makes, say, $500,000 a year EBIT. It's good for us. But in America, you know, if it goes wrong, it's an enormous problem for you. So we're looking for bigger businesses. So that already makes it more competitive and more expensive. And we keep trying. We have less deal flow, so we try less than in the UK, but we haven't succeeded. So I hope that answers. And of course, bigger deals. Yeah, we always look at bigger deals, and you know, one day we'll do a bigger deal, but we have to be convinced it works. Now, in terms of, sorry, because I did let Mark answer Sanjay's other question.
Sure. So in terms of scalability, I think what I've done to start with was put in place a lot of things which enable the companies to interact with each other. And once that's been kicked off in a way that can be self-fulfilling. So, you know, I get the MDs together once or twice a year. They now know all each other. They interchange views. If one of them's opening an office in Germany, the three or four other people who can give them help and that sort of interaction, HR issues, etc. I've got together an operations network who can trade stories and ideas about that. So that's got a momentum of its own going. On the day-to-day basis, though, I do spend a lot of time going around the companies. So, you know, I'm going from here to see two of our companies and tomorrow a couple more. You know, could I cope with one more company? Of course. Could I cope with twice as many companies? No. I mean, in my previous group, I was responsible for seven businesses on two occasions, and only seven rather than 14 or 16. But they were based in, Colchester, South Wales, Newcastle, one in France, one in Holland, one in Ohio, and one in Melbourne, Australia. So the travel was dramatically different. So in terms of workload, I think 14 businesses in the south of England and seven around the world is not very different. But I think that, you know, if we had another eight businesses tomorrow, then I think we just need another version of me, really. And whether that's someone, reporting to me as an assistant, or whether it's someone on, you know, the same level, I'm sort of agnostic about. A little bit of coaching, a little bit of experience of running these types of businesses, and just keeping that gentle, encouraging pressure on for the month-to-month results. So I think, you know, an additional person over the next two or three years hopefully will be needed, because that will mean we've delivered the acquisitions that everybody likes.
Would you expand your EBIT multiple if you found a complementary business where you'd find economies of scale after acquisition?
Yes.
Would you be more open-minded to price?
Yeah. First, I have to say, we're open-minded but tight-fisted. Okay.
But if your benefits are that much greater, then...
I think, like, first we bought you know, a business once that was making no money because we thought it could make money added to another business. It was in 2011, KE Development. We really brought the whole, you know, the whole business into Devon, and we couldn't have a multiple because it was a multiple of nothing. So so we're very open-minded, but I think we're also conscious of the fact that if we buy a business which is similar to other business we will buy in the future, and we pay a higher multiple, people will realize this. And you know, like, the people who sell us business, they're really intelligent people. And they, you know, they all look at our website and they know every deal we've done. And they say, oh, why are you offering me this? Because this guy, by the way, I know him, you know, and you pay him four times. Why is my business only worth three times? So, you know, we have to be aware of the consequence of paying more for a business. But of course, yeah, then you can explain it. You say, yeah, there were synergies. And yeah, for a business which is synergistic, we might actually be a bit less disciplined. But we have to be disciplined. And of course, you know, if we found that, you know, we're not managing to do any deals at all, then we have to be open-minded and say, well, maybe we have to be a little bit less tight-fisted, but you know that you can't go back on it easily. So it's not like you, if you have a bad year, you can say, it's a bad year, I'll pay more, and then we'll have good years again, we'll pay less, because you don't pay less. But if you find it doesn't work, then you have to say, okay, how, we know it's quite sensitive to price, so how sensitive is it, and do we prefer to do a lot less deals and to pay, or do we want to pay a bit more and accelerate the rate of deals that you do? There's no doubt that if we paid more, we'd do more deals, you know? But would shareholders make more money? That's the question. So, what, you know,
I guess when interest rates are so low, you know, you're still making a very good return, even if you were.
Yeah, it is. You know, I have no doubt that we could do more deals and make more earnings per share for a period of time by paying more. But if you take a 10-year view and you look at that, it's a different thing. But of course, if you start accumulating vast amounts of cash, then you have to say, okay, you know, what do I do? I mean, maybe the market has changed and maybe we should look at it and maybe we should pay a bit more, or maybe we should give money back to shareholders, or we should do something else. You understand? You know, we're always open-minded on everything, but we're also disciplined. And I think we need good reason to change what we do.
You talked about buying businesses for life. Is there a situation where you would consider selling a business?
Yes, I think there would be. I think, by the way, we've had a lot of approaches to sell some of our businesses. We haven't succumbed. I mean, I think what you have to see is unlikely, because just as much as, you know, you've all understood this equation of interest rates and the multiple we pay. And this is why, you know, whenever we do a deal, we say, well, it's immediately earnings enhancing. It's not a big risk we take by saying that thing. So, of course, it means that any disposal will be earnings dilutive. But it could be that we bought a business which we felt was like a judge's business, and it's not, and we change our mind about that business, or maybe the environment has changed. You know, like some businesses we've had 14 years, so maybe they were niche and they're not niche anymore. The world has changed. And, you know, is it a business we want to keep? So it is possible that, yeah, it could happen that we sell a business, but we'd be really greedy.
How important has low interest, has low price of sterling been to your business?
It's really good. I mean, when sterling was 1.7 in 2014, we didn't have a good year. Throughout the business, we're really comfortable until 1.4, 1.5. But of course, you know, we get better margin, we're more competitive, we love low sterling, we're an exporter, and we have something like £10 million of income every year in currency, you know, mostly the dollar, but also euro, and, you know, it's worth more money. So to us, it's very good. And even for the things we sell in sterling, people who buy these products, they don't think in sterling. So they convert it and say, oh, how much dollar it is? Oh, that's not too expensive. So yes, it's significant.
Significant. And if sterling went up, would that hurt your business a lot?
I would say when sterling goes up, because of course when the whole Brexit shenanigan is over, you know, there's a really good chance that sterling will go up, unless there was a Labour government, when then sterling would be really low. And yeah, sterling will go up, and I think it's not great for our business, but it's not fatal. But it's not fatal, but it's bad if it goes back too fast, too high. And I was giving the example of 2014 was not a good year for us. But still, we made money. We didn't do a deal, but we did a deal in January 15. So we had the ability to conduct our business model, but it was not quite as good. We prefer low sterling.
Right, one for Brad and one for Mark, if I may. In terms of the financial side, how do you keep working capital so low? I mean, it's given that you're selling into academic institutions or large organisations, especially in Europe, the debtor days seems very low. Is there anything special that you...
Well, I mean, you'd almost, I said with a smile on my face, it almost sounds like we might be like magicians or something about this. It's not at all. It's good discipline. Now, some of our businesses, because you're often ordering things that are made to order, will require some money up front. So that can often happen. And don't get me wrong, these are not like one-year lead times, but sometimes you order something that's a special and you realise that actually we've got to order a bunch of parts that we wouldn't otherwise order, so therefore we'd ask for some payment in advance. Academic institutions are blue chip. So they generally pay well. You agree sensible payment terms with them and they generally pay on time. We work with blue chips in industry as well. The OEMs, the same thing. You know, it's very much. I sleep well at night because I know we're going to get paid. And where we have any risk, and particularly if we're selling to developing countries or into countries that we're not used to doing a lot of business or we don't know the customer that well, we often use letters of credit, which again will secure the payment. So a mixture of all of those. And good credit control that goes with it. And, you know, as Mark pointed out earlier, sometimes just helping everyone understand what our best practices are around the group can be very, very helpful. And just going, oh, right, well, maybe I can just think about reminding them a little bit more quickly. And interestingly, something Mark did when he first joined was we always had monthly management reports from the businesses. One thing he asked for is, to put a little extra note on the management report that we get from each company each month about any debtors over a certain size that are more than X number of days. Right. And I think the MDs probably felt like, oh, if I have to say something about this, I'm a bit embarrassed. So all of a sudden, after the first month when they had to say the things they had to say, within 3 months, it may have been quicker than that, Mark, all of a sudden, like, you've got blank pieces of reporting from everybody because they're thinking, well, I don't want anyone at the board level to be seeing I'm not collecting my debts. Lo and behold, and it wasn't even anything of any significance other than please provide us with this information. And now, you know, that little nudge has really helped. So it doesn't require rocket science. It just requires good discipline.
Thank you. And Mark, in terms of more generally across the group, are there any things that you're considering looking to offer to all or a large subset of the operating companies. I'm thinking about things like the Internet of Things and connectivity suddenly becoming a big trend across certain segments of the market. And if they're looking to invest in that or develop functionality or connectivity themselves, that might be individually quite expensive. So a kind of pool, a shared group expertise might be quite helpful. And I know that's starting to evolve from things like HR and accounting and that, those sorts of things, but how far might that go? Is that something you...
Sure. I think on that specific area of product development, my view is that we're not there yet. We don't need that. I believe in the same way that I answered the question over there from Robin, I think that actually we've got lower hanging fruit than that. And if we'd got to the point where all of the companies were developing great new products and to their limit, and then we could add another layer on top, then I think that would be sensible. But I think there really are a number of opportunities, not enormous ones, but a number of opportunities just to optimise within the business before we start doing it across. Now, I do think, though, that there are one or two areas outside product development. So, for instance, one initiative that we're looking at the moment is that if you're a small business employing, it seems ridiculous, but 20 people, your first step abroad is pretty challenging with distributors. If you actually put a person abroad, it's probably going to be America first. People feel more comfortable at that. But something like China is absolutely terrifying. So we are just beginning to pursue a group initiative where we're looking at having something in China, which would mean that the companies were able to operate there with no effort rather than having to do a lot of stuff themselves. So still a few things to think about, but giving them a footprint in China, which means that we could bring that closer to home. So yes, there are a few areas, but the one you specifically quoted, not yet, I think.
Thank you, everyone. You know everything if you have no more questions. And thank you for coming. And we hope to see you in March.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.